Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are cracking open the dossier on someone truly multifaceted in modern entertainment, Wayne Alfonso Brady.
Right. And if you're like most people, you probably immediately think improv genius, right? The guy on Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Exactly. Making up those amazing songs on the spot. But, you know, the goal of this deep dive is really to explore the staggering breadth of his career. It goes way beyond just the improv comedy.
It really does. When you actually analyze the sources, his journey, it reveals this pattern of intentional versatility and resilience, too. He's constantly seeking out new formats to, well, to master.
So our mission today is to track that evolution. He's a TV host, a comedian, an actor, a serious singer.
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers alone, they're kind of shocking. 5 Emmy Awards.
Yeah.
Across 3 completely different types of programming.
Yeah, think about that. Improv, talk shows, and game shows.
That's wild.
Absolutely. And that's the crucial nugget hook, really. 5 Emmys across 3 genres. I mean, how often does a performer achieve that kind of sustained mastery in formats that are so different? Competitive improv, scripted drama.
And then you add the 2 Grammy nominations on top of that.
Exactly. Showing he's dead serious as a recording artist, it suggests he isn't just, you know, talented. He's exceptionally adaptable.
And that adaptability, you're saying, it was forged by overcoming some pretty significant early challenges.
That seems to be the case. Yeah, we're going to dig into that.
So was this like a deliberate strategy to avoid being typecast? Or was it maybe driven by something deeper, more personal? We're going to examine the story of this man, born June 2, 1972, and reveal how some formative struggles, things like stuttering, anxiety, might have actually fueled the very skills that made him famous.
Okay, so let's unpack this journey, really starting from the roots. Brady was born in Columbus, Georgia. His parents were West Indian, but his environment, it fundamentally shifted pretty early on. He moved to Orlando, Florida.
Right, and he was raised primarily by his grandmother, Valerie Peterson.
That's right, yeah, whom he affectionately calls his mom. And that domestic stability, it seems pretty foundational when you look at things. It does. But what's fascinating here, and you touched on this, is the resilience required just to navigate childhood. Our sources detail that as a child, Brady developed this really debilitating stutter.
Yeah. Which, as you can imagine, led to significant bullying. And consequently, severe anxiety, especially around speaking in public.
Which is just the irony, right?
It's a perfect example of that powerful irony shaping a career. I mean, the man who built an empire on instantaneous, smooth, articulate dialogue. He originally struggled just to get simple concepts out without, you know, verbal paralysis. It's almost like a movie origin story for a performer.
So how did he break through that paralysis?
Well, he found his gateway, sort of, at age 16 through community theater. But the real key, it seems, was the Orlando Improvisation Troupe, SA Comedy Lab.
Huh? Okay, SA Comedy Lab.
Yeah. Think about it. Yeah. For someone with a stutter and anxiety, traditional scripted theater, it's safe, sure, but maybe limiting. Improv, though. It requires that instant, non-judgmental acceptance of ideas, that whole yes and principle.
Right, yes. It forces this instantaneous communication flow. Perfection isn't the goal. Connection is.
That's a really powerful distinction. Improv, by its nature, demands you accept and just run with the first thought. So it bypasses that anxious self-editing that often causes or worsens stuttering. It forces the brain to prioritize what flow over flaw.
Precisely. That immersion in SA Comedy Lab, it created this kind of muscle memory for quick thinking, for instant character creation. And this training was immediately put to the test in his very first professional job.
Which were where? Universal Studios, right?
Yep. Universal Studios, Florida. And this detail, it's often overlooked. He wasn't just performing, he was working that theme park grind, specifically in shows related to the Beetlejuice franchise.
Beetlejuice, what roles?
Yes. The sources specify 2 crucial gigs. He was in Beetlejuice, Dead in Concert, playing Winston Zeddemore from Ghostbusters.
Okay.
And then in Beetlejuice's Rock and Roll Graveyard Review, he portrayed Dracula.
Wow. So Dracula, very physical, deep voice, and then Winston Zeddemore, more contemporary, quick-witted. Doing those back-to-back, that requires instant command of physicality, voice, character archetype.
It's essentially a high-pressure masterclass in character study, especially for someone still developing those foundational skills.
Well, you can see how that connects directly to the agility that became his trademark on Whose Line.
Absolutely. That theme park work, the fast pace of SA Comedy Lab, it served as the perfect spontaneous training ground, honing that verbal and physical dexterity needed for high-stakes, unscripted TV.
And this foundation eventually fueled his move, where, Los Angeles.
Exactly. A strategic move to LA in 1996 to further develop his acting. And that pretty directly led to his national television exposure not long after.
Okay, so that LA move, it quickly put him into that that sort of nascent world of television comedy competitions. Before the huge hit, he was a recurring contestant on Quick Wits, right? From 96 to 99.
That's right, yeah. Often partnered with Frank Maciel. It shows he was already competing, grinding it out in that improv TV landscape before Whose Line really blew up stateside.
It was a crucial proving ground, I imagine.
Definitely. But the true international launchpad was, of course, Whose Line Is It? Anyway. And interestingly, he started on the original British version first.
Yeah, well, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, back in 1998, it was filmed in Hollywood, but it was the UK version with Clive Anderson, Ryan Stiles, Colin Mochrie, before he became such a fixture on the American version with Drew Carey.
Okay. And this is where we get to that really nuanced achievement, the one that highlights his extraordinary mastery, the 2003 Primetime Emmy.
Yes, for outstanding individual performance in a variety or music program for his work on Whose Line.
And we need to pause here because that sounds impressive. But why is it so remarkable?
Well, most awards in that specific category, they're given for a one-off performance, you know, a specific, highly polished TV special where the artist gets to plan and practice their absolute best material. Brady won the award for his work on a television series.
Okay, so winning for a series versus a special.
Yeah.
What does that imply? What's the difference?
It implies sustained, reliable, high-level quality, week after week. It means the judges weren't just impressed by one great song or one hilarious sketch. They were impressed by his ability to maintain that spontaneous brilliance episode after episode throughout an entire season.
Wow.
And the sources confirm this was incredibly rare. He was the only person since Dana Carvey, way back in 1993, to win that specific award for a recurring role on a series.
So it's an acknowledgement that his talent wasn't just situational. It was, like, foundational to the show's continuous success.
Exactly. He wasn't just surviving in that improv ecosystem. He was, you know, functionally a tentpole of the genre. He was kind of defining how musical improv was done on television.
And he kept those connections close, didn't he? Appearing on Drew Live episodes of The Drew Carey Show.
Right. Jumping across the pond for the UK improv show Fast and Loose, participating in Drew Carey's improvaganza, he stayed very much within that circle.
And that connection really culminated when he returned for the CW's revival of Whose Line in 2013.
Yes. And critically, he took on a dual role there, performer and executive producer.
That EP role, that's telling. It signifies a shift, right? From just talent for hire to being a key creative stakeholder.
Ensuring the format he helped define was, I guess, protected and executed correctly for a new generation?
Absolutely. But critically, his versatility wasn't just professional. It became strategic in terms of his public perception, too. By, say, 2004, he'd solidified this very specific public image.
Yeah, the family-friendly, always cheerful, clean-cut musical improv guy.
Exactly. And he risked all of that goodwill, potentially, by appearing on Chappelle's Show.
Ah, yes. The legendary sketch where he completely skewered his own squeaky clean persona.
That sketch was just a masterstroke of self-awareness. By going on Chappelle's Show and playing this terrifying, profane, gangster version of himself, he basically showed everyone he knew what people were saying. That maybe his image was a bit too vanilla.
Right. It was crucial for staying relevant. Totally. It proved he wasn't trapped by his own clean brand. He was playing with it. He demonstrated depth, maybe an edgy side to the industry and the audience. He was in on the joke.
And that self-awareness, it clearly extended into his diverse voice work too, showing he could adapt his vocal talent completely away from his physical persona.
Absolutely. The sources list a really varied voice career. You've got the sci-fi action of Micron in Batman Beyond, the long-running, really crucial voice role of Clover the Rabbit in the animated kids series Sophia the First.
A huge hit with kids.
Huge. And then more recently, the wonderfully villainous King Dice in the Cuphead show. That movement between genres, between demographics, it demonstrates an ability to synthesize totally different vocal approaches, which, you know, he no doubt perfected doing those instant character voices in his improv work.
So the mastery he showed in improv clearly gave him the confidence to lead his own projects. And he quickly translated that Whose Line's success into solo hosting ventures. But the sources show an interesting sort of trial and error period first with the two distinct Wayne Brady Show eras.
That's a key insight into how TV programming works, yeah. First, there was that short-lived variety show on ABC back in 2001.
Right. That didn't last long.
No, it failed pretty quickly. Likely because, well, variety shows are notoriously hard to pull off in primetime. They need massive budgets, consistent, big-name star power to compete against established sitcoms and dramas. It's a tough nut to crack.
But then, the very next year, 2002, he launched the second version, the daytime talk show, same name. And that one clicked.
Yeah, that format lasted 2 seasons and proved to be a much better fit for him.
Why daytime, do you think?
Well, the daytime format allowed for more intimacy, you know, that spontaneous interaction with the audience, with guests. It was structured enough to give him control, but loose enough that he could really utilize his improvisational quick wit. And it clearly worked.
It did. He won 2 consecutive daytime Emmy Awards for Outstanding Talk Show Host, 2003-2004, back to back.
Right. He proved he could command a highly structured stage just as effectively as an unscripted one, which is not easy.
And following that success, he cycled through several other specialized hosting roles. I remember Don't Forget the Lyrics on Fox. That was 2007 to 2009.
Yep, the singing game show. And he also briefly hosted a TV Land talk show called That's What I'm Talking About. That one specifically focused on the vital role of African Americans in the entertainment industry. A bit more niche, but important.
And those roles, those different formats, they kind of served as the perfect warm-up for what became his greatest sustained hosting success.
The revival of Let's Make a Deal, absolutely. He took over in October 2009, and it's become his longest-running role by far, still going strong.
And this wasn't just any old slot they gave him. The show came with significant institutional weight behind it. It replaced the iconic, long-running soap opera Guiding Light.
Huge shoes to fill, which meant he had to immediately prove the viability of this new daytime game show format in that specific time slot. High pressure.
And he had to carry a legacy too, right?
He did. Our sources note that the original host, the legendary Monty Hall, served as a consultant until his death in 2017. So Brady got that kind of stamp of historical approval.
And if you watch Let's Make a Deal closely, you really see the improv skills in action constantly.
Oh, every single episode. How does it translate specifically, you think, beyond just being quick-witted?
Well, it's the spontaneous singing, for one.
Yeah.
The instant character adoption he needs to interact with contestants in these wild costumes, and maybe most importantly, that crucial ability to manage unpredictable emotional swings.
Right. People winning big, losing everything on a zonk.
Yeah, he has to react authentically, immediately, keep the energy up, maintain the flow, all without a script, while hitting his marks, managing prize reveals.
It's a very high-wire act, actually, and the audience clearly loves it.
And here's that fantastic bit of trivia that brings us full circle. By 2019, both shows in the CBS daytime game show lineup, Let's Make a Deal and The Price is Right, were hosted by, whose line is it? Anyway, alumni, Brady and Drew Carey.
That speaks volumes, doesn't it? About the value of that specific kind of improv training in a mass audience broadcast environment.
Definitely. And while he had numerous Emmy nominations for Let's Make a Deal, I think 7 before his first win?
Something like that, yeah. He eventually secured the Daytime Emmy for Outstanding Game Show Host in 2018. And then, showing his sort of holistic approach to the show, he picked up a 2nd Emmy for LMAD just recently in 2024.
But not for hosting this time.
No, for Outstanding Original Song, for the show itself. He wrote music for it, too. So he's mastering the content from, like, every possible angle.
It's important to stress, though, that while he's been dominating daytime TV for over a decade, he hasn't let his acting muscle atrophy at all. He's been consistently picking up some pretty high-profile scripted roles during this same period.
Yes, absolutely, showcasing that versatility again. On the comedy side, he had that great recurring guest role on How I Met Your Mother, James Stinson.
Neil Patrick Harris's brother, Barney's brother.
Yeah, the openly gay brother, right? Which required this really subtle comedic performance, playing off Harris beautifully for, what, 13 episodes?
Sounds about right. And he also did a great turn on Everybody Hates Chris.
As Lewis, yeah. Julius Rock's highly gifted, sometimes kind of grating younger brother.
And then stepping completely outside comedy, yeah. He wasn't afraid to take a serious sci-fi turn. Trailak on Stargate SG-1.
Right. That shift from a comedic brother on AMIM to an alien dignitary on Stargate,
yeah,
that's a massive leap in tone and style.
And then just for sheer, like, pop culture weirdness,
yeah,
we can't forget the WWE thing.
Oh, yeah. His guest host spot on WWE Raw back in 2010, which ended with him taking an RKO, that famous wrestling move from Randy Orton.
You gotta love it.
It's just a testament to his willingness to participate fully in absolutely any corner of the entertainment landscape. No matter how absurd or physically demanding it might be, he jumps in.
Okay, so while the rest of his schedule seems completely packed, we absolutely have to turn now to his serious, critically acclaimed career on the legitimate stage. This is where that vocal prowess, which maybe it started as a comedic tool on Whose Line, really became a true artistic instrument.
Yeah, his musical theater career really kicked off in a big way in 2004. He joined the Broadway revival of Chicago, playing the smooth, sophisticated lawyer, Billy Flynn.
Billy Flynn, huge role. But his later roles, that's where his artistic range truly, I think, solidified.
Let's just trace the sheer weight of some of these Broadway roles. It's impressive.
Okay.
He took on the extremely challenging role of Lola Simon in Kinky Boots on Broadway. He did a run from late 2015, early 2016, and then actually returned again in 2018.
Lola is such a demanding role.
Incredibly demanding. Lola's a drag queen who requires immense vulnerability, serious vocal power, and just seamless physical commitment. It's a role that demands the actor fully synthesize their acting and their musical skills at the highest level.
And then came Hamilton.
That's right. Stepping into a cultural phenomenon like Hamilton, that's always a high-stakes move for any performer. He played the coveted role of Aaron Burr.
The room where it happens.
Exactly. In the Chicago production, from January to April 2017, playing Burr requires meticulous rhythm, that rapid-fire lyrical delivery, and a really deep understanding of the character's complex internal conflict. All skills, arguably perfectly aligned with his improv timing and quick thinking.
He also tackled the seminal rock opera Rent, playing Tom Collins in a stage production at the Hollywood Bowl in 2010. And that production, interestingly, was directed by
Neil Patrick Harris again, his former co-star. It just shows how closely intertwined his professional network really is. These collaborators keep coming back together.
And most recently, just this year, 2024, he took on the titular role, The Wiz, in the U.S. national tour and the subsequent Broadway revival of The Wiz.
All this stage work really confirms his identity as a serious musician, you know, not just a comedian who happens to be able to sing well. And this is backed up by his debut album, A Long Time Coming, which came out back in 2008.
And the ultimate validation, perhaps, came from the Recording Academy, the Grammys.
Correct. He earned a Grammy nomination for Best Traditional R&B Vocal Performance. And importantly, it was for his cover of the iconic Sam Cooke song, A Change Is Gonna Come.
Wow. Taking on Sam Cooke.
Exactly. That's a performance that demands profound emotional authenticity, real vocal artistry. Getting a nomination for covering such a legendary, historically significant song, it immediately establishes his credibility completely outside the comedy sphere.
And he just secured a second Grammy nomination too, right? For The Wiz.
Yes, in 2025 for Best Musical Theater Album for The Wiz original cast recording. It just reinforces his standing as a leading figure in the modern theater community today.
We also need to pause and appreciate his participation in that really unique kind of modern phenomenon, Ratatouille the Musical in 2021.
Oh yeah, the TikTok musical.
Explain the novelty there for anyone who might have missed this truly unique moment in, like, digital performance history.
Well, it represents the absolute bleeding edge of collaborative creation, really. It started as an internet meme, just people on TikTok making up songs about the movie Ratatouille. And it organically grew into this full-fledged virtual benefit concert.
Amazing.
And Brady jumped in alongside other major Broadway and film stars to perform in the virtual presentation. He starred as Django, Remy's father. And the whole thing raised over $1 million for the Actors Fund during the pandemic.
That just shows he's not only versatile in traditional formats, but he's always willing to pivot, to embrace modern, digitally innovative ways to use his theatrical and musical skills. He stays current.
That desire for modern relevance probably also led him to competitive reality TV.
The Masked Singer. He won season 2 back in 2019 as Fox.
Right, which served as yet another platform to showcase his vocal excellence to a huge mass audience who might still only know him from Whose Line or Let's Make a Deal. He later came back as a guest panelist and performer as Mr. TV, showing his continued connection to that show's whole universe.
And we also see some significant dramatic turns during this period, too, keeping those straight acting chops sharp.
Precisely. He took on recurring roles like Everett Kynes in the sci-fi drama Colony in 2018. And then he stepped into the DC Comics universe as Tyson Sykes, Gravedigger, on Black Lightning in 2020.
Those roles are grounded in intensity, serious dramatic delivery. a world away from the bright lights and comedy of his game show hosting.
Totally different gear. And he even competed on Dancing with the Stars season 31 in 2022, finished third place with Whitney Carson.
Which is intense physical training, and you could argue that connects all the way back to the physical agility required for improv and stage work. It all feeds each other.
It seems to. And when you look ahead, his immediate future proves this strategy of, like, non-specialization is absolutely ongoing. He's slated to play Harold Zidler in Moulin Rouge, the musical on Broadway in 2025.
Another huge role.
Huge. And he'll be returning to his main voice role as Clover in Sophia the First, Royal Magic in 2026. He is deliberately, actively operating across all possible platforms simultaneously. It's quite remarkable.
Okay, so for this final deepest dive, we need to shift focus entirely. Moving away from the professional achievements, impressive as they are, to the profound authenticity of his personal life, which, especially recently, has added this incredible layer of transparency to his public persona.
Yeah, this is crucial to understand in the Wayne Brady of today. We have to first discuss his unique and, by all accounts, highly functional family structure. He's been married twice, first to Diana Lasso, then to Mandy Takeda, and he shares one daughter with Mandy, born in 2003.
And the emphasis nugget here, and this really is genuinely remarkable in Hollywood or anywhere, is that despite their divorce back in 2008, the sources really stress that he and Mandy Takeda remain extremely close friends and co-parents.
They really do seem to model that modern, healthy post-divorce family life. They often appear together publicly, support each other's projects. It's quite something.
And that family unit recently expanded, right?
Yes. In 2024, he revealed quite openly that he has a son named Val. From an intimate relationship he had during the sort of isolation of the COVID-19 pandemic, and his willingness to discuss such personal evolving family dynamics so openly, it reinforces this larger commitment to honesty that seems to be dominating his recent career phase.
And that commitment to honesty extends crucially to his mental health journey.
Yeah.
He's been extremely candid about suffering from clinical depression.
Yes. Specifically, he shared that he experienced a severe mental breakdown on his 42nd birthday back in 2014.
That's incredibly vulnerable to share publicly.
It really is. And it's a powerful detail because he publicly credited his ex-wife, Mandy Takeda, with providing vital support during that time, helping him recover from that crisis. It highlights how that foundational family bond wasn't just, you know, healthy for co-parenting. It was literally life-saving for him.
Wow. And beyond mental health, he's also powerfully confronted issues of public identity, particularly around race. This really came to a head back in 2013, didn't it, with Bill Maher?
Yes. During a public discussion, Bill Maher compared Brady to then-President Barack Obama, suggesting that both were viewed in popular culture as somehow not black enough.
Which is such a loaded and problematic concept.
Extremely. And this was really a pivotal moment in how Brady chose to define his public image moving forward. His public reaction was strong, immediate, and highly reflective. He forcefully rejected that statement.
What did he say?
He essentially told Maher he needed to be careful when he makes statements like that because it reinforces harmful, limiting, stereotypical assumptions about what Black identity must look like to be considered authentic by others.
So it was a direct confrontation of that clean image narrative that he'd kind of been playing with since the Chappelle Show sketch years earlier. But this time, the stakes felt much higher. It was about his fundamental right to define himself.
Exactly. And that powerful rejection of narrow identity boundaries, it really culminated in a major personal announcement in August 2023.
His announcement that he came out as pansexual.
Yes. This step further solidifies his public identity as one rooted in genuine, honest self-acceptance. It completely shatters any lingering notion of that two-dimensional, squeaky clean, easy-to-define persona that perhaps the media, or even some parts of the audience, had previously tried to box him into.
So he's now really emerged as a figure who embraces complexity, fluidity,
mm-hmm.
both professionally and personally.
He has. But this transparency, this willingness to be vulnerable and authentic, it has also placed him in some complex ethical waters recently, particularly when making high-profile professional choices. And we should impartially report on a recent controversy involving an upcoming engagement.
Right. The sources mention his planned participation in the Riyadh Comedy Festival in Saudi Arabia, scheduled for 2025, alongside other major international comedians.
And the discussion surrounding this, as you can imagine, is highly nuanced and charged. Human Rights Watch publicly characterized the event and others like it as an attempt by the Saudi government to, quote, whitewash its human rights abuses through high-profile entertainment and cultural events.
Which puts an artist like Brady, who has been increasingly vocal about marginalized identities and mental health advocacy, in a potentially difficult position. And just to be crystal clear for our listeners, we are only reporting the facts of the criticism and the event itself. We're not taking a side on this.
Absolutely not. That's crucial. For the artist, participating in global festivals like this often involves really complex calculations. There's the desire for global exposure, the financial incentives, maybe even the idea that cultural presence itself might foster engagement or exchange down the line.
But for his critics.
Right. For his critics, accepting the paycheck, appearing on that stage, means implicitly validating the hosting government, regardless of the artist's personal politics or intentions. And given Brady's high profile, and especially now that he has cultivated such a transparent, values-driven personal identity, his choices in arenas like this are inevitably going to be met with intense scrutiny.
It shows that his career really isn't just about the jokes or the songs or the game show prizes anymore. It's increasingly about the complex person behind the persona, a person who has chosen to define himself through vulnerability and a kind of political self-determination. And that means navigating some very real-world ethical challenges publicly.
So when you step back, this deep dive has revealed that Wayne Brady's career isn't just some random sequence of jobs he fell into. It looks much more like a unified, relentless pursuit of mastery across, well, pretty much every single entertainment medium imaginable.
Yeah, we started with him overcoming that debilitating stutter, performing as Dracula at a theme park. And we traced that path all the way to achieving that incredibly rare Emmy for sustained improv excellence and headlining culturally iconic Broadway musicals like Hamilton and The Wiz.
He's really become a study in relentless versatility,
yeah,
demonstrating that sustained success across completely disparate fields, improv, hosting, dramatic acting, musical theater, it is achievable, but it seems to require an absolute mastery of the fundamentals. Timing, rhythm, quick thinking, and maybe most crucially, emotional availability and honesty.
The core insight, I think, for the listener here is that Brady's continued relevance seems to hinge not just on his undeniable talent, but increasingly on his willingness to embrace and publicly discuss deep personal complexity.
Right, from clinical depression and those complicated modern co-parenting dynamics, all the way to his pansexuality. His trajectory really suggests a growing trend where sustained professional success might increasingly rely on, or at least be deeply intertwined with, vulnerability and authenticity, even as he navigates those tricky geopolitical waters we just discussed.
He didn't let any single success define him, did he? He was the funny black comedian from Whose Line, then he was a legitimate Broadway star, then a beloved daytime host, and now he's also a vocal advocate for mental health and identity fluidity. It feels like the ultimate display of career control, maybe not control over the scene itself, but control over his own narrative.
Indeed. So here's a final thought to leave you with. In a world just saturated with information, with carefully curated personas, how much of Wayne Brady's enduring success is derived not just from that exceptional, quick-witted talent we all saw, and Whose Line Is It Anyway, but from his deliberate, ongoing choice to actively reinvent his public identity, rather than simply maintaining a comfortable, maybe safer status quo? That conscious choice to evolve, to reveal more, to become more complex publicly, perhaps that is his most enduring and maybe his most impressive performance of all.